Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate.
What's that you're eating?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli. It turns out the Food and Drug Administration isn't necessarily keeping such close tabs on the nation's food supply. Word is they inspect less than 1% of all imported food. A typical inspector in one office looks at 1,000 food items a day, or one every 30 seconds. So says the Wall Street Journal. That information was leaked in advance of today's subcommittee hearing on the Hill about food safety after the tainted Chinese product scare. One idea lawmakers have been floating around for a while now has to do with country of origin labeling on certain products. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson says now that idea just might have legs.
Country of origin labeling became mandatory on many food products in 2002, but strong lobbying by big meat producers has delayed most implementation until next year. Now lawmakers are trying to push that deadline up. That's partly because of concern about the safety of imported foods, says Chris Waldrop at Consumer Federation of America.
I think the consumer wants to have more information about the source of their food and where their food is coming from when they're buying it in the supermarket.
But some meat producers are wary of mandatory labeling.
This particular law doesn't require a label. It requires a biography.
Janet Riley is with the American Meat Institute.
The label would have to say where an animal was born, where it was raised, and where it was slaughtered.
She says that kind of information would be costly and difficult to keep track of. Both sides doubt that new regulations will be in place this year, but say meat producers are eventually going to have to live with longer labels. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
How now, Dow Jones? Some movement in the continuing saga of the News Corp takeover of the financial news giant. Last night, both sides reached a tentative agreement for Rupert Murdoch to buy the empire that includes the Wall Street Journal. Tonight, the Dow Jones board gets to vote. Thursday's when the Bancroft family, which has voting control over the stock, sits down to meet. They'll be given several days to make a decision. Where they stand is said to be too close to call. On Wall Street Monday, the Dow closed up 43 points to 13,950. The Nasdaq closed down 10 to 2697, and the S&P closed down 3 to 1549. The Avon lady came calling on Monday, and she was not bearing skin so soft. She had news of layoffs. Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports on restructuring at the cosmetics giant.
No, the Avon lady is not getting pink slipped. Justin Hott, managing director at Bear Stearns, says Avon is making cuts at the top.
They're trying to eliminate levels of management. You don't need over a dozen levels of management.
The company is also relocating call centers to cheaper countries, where Avon's future customers are. Market research firm TNS says Chinese women will buy $3.8 billion worth of cosmetics in 2009. China ended a ban on direct sales last year. Since then, Avon has recruited more than 650,000 Avon ladies there. 45,000 women a month are signing up.
They're selling a model where not only you're buying cosmetics, but you're building your own little mini business there. And that is a very attractive thing to China.
Some investors don't like Avon because it's still in the midst of a $500 million makeover. Others seem to think the Avon lady's cleaning up pretty well. The stock's up 33% in the last year. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. By Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by American Public Media's weekly program, Speaking of Faith. Starting July 19th, Krista Tippett explores the ethics of eating with author Barbara Kingsolver, speakingoffaith.org.
A few weeks ago, a pair of Irish hedge funds filed for bankruptcy after some risky investments went south. Ritchie Capital had invested in what are called life settlement policies. That's basically where investors buy life insurance policies and profit when the original policyholders die. As Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, it's not the only way investors are cashing in on matters of life and death.
You've probably seen the ads on cable.
If you're a senior like me, you may be surprised at how much you can be paid for your life insurance. Call J.G. Wentworth.
If you're over 65 and short on cash, you can sell your life insurance policy to a company like J.G. Wentworth. So-called life settlement companies pool your policy with others and sell it on to investors in the form of a bond. Nick Potter is an attorney with the law firm Debevoise & Plimpton. He says unlike viatical settlement companies that target the terminally ill, life settlement companies focus on healthy seniors.
Someone who feels that, well, I could use the money now, and I might as well sell the policy and have someone else wager on the duration of my life.
Ghoulish? Certainly. Shady? Perhaps. Life settlement firm Coventry First is under investigation. State officials say the company may have underpaid people who sold their policies. Those bankrupt Ritchie Capital hedge funds invested in Coventry's life settlements. Investors are exploring all sorts of ways to make money on your life or death. Mortality bonds, for example. They're issued by insurance companies to offset the risk of a natural disaster or pandemic. Alex Krutoff is a consultant with Navigation Advisors. He says when many policyholders die all at once, insurers are on the hook for a large amount of cash. Mortality bonds transfer that risk to investors.
If something happens, investors would lose money because those funds will go to insurance companies to help pay the claims to policyholders.
But if no disaster strikes, investors get paid, and handsomely. The idea is catching on. Fitch Ratings says last year insurers sold almost $5.5 billion in bonds related to mortality and life insurance. But if some insurers worry about policyholders dying, others fear they'll live too long. One academic's come up with what he calls a longevity bond. Insurers and pension funds could buy the bonds to offset the risk of beneficiaries living longer than expected. So far, he hasn't found any takers. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli. Enjoy your day. American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.